On this 23rd day of March 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, General History, Chapter 18, Description of the Varnashram Dharma System, and we're on text 44. Iti mam yakswadharmena bhaje nityamananya bhak sarva bhuteshu madbhavo man bhaktim vindate dvidham. One who worships me, this is Krishna speaking to Uddhava, continuing the Uddhava Gita, one who worships me by his prescribed duty, having no other object of worship, and who remains conscious of me as present in all living entities, achieves unflinching devotional service unto me. Purport. It is clearly explained in this verse that loving devotional service unto Lord Krishna is the ultimate goal of the entire Varnashram system, which the Lord has been elaborately explaining. In any social or occupational division of human society, one must be a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and worship Him alone. The bona fide spiritual master is the representative of Lord Krishna, and worship of the Acharya goes directly to the lotus feet of the Lord. Although ordinary householders are sometimes ordered by Vedic injunctions to worship particular demigods or forefathers, one should remember that Lord Krishna is within all living entities. As stated here, sarvabhuteshu madbhavah. The pure devotees of the Lord worship the Lord alone, and those who cannot come to the standard of pure devotional service should at least meditate upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead within the demigods and all other living entities, understanding that all religious processes are ultimately meant for the pleasure of the Lord. In the course of missionary work, even pure devotees must deal with government leaders and other prominent members of society, sometimes praising such persons and complying with their orders. Yet because the devotees are always meditating on Lord Krishna, situated as the supersoul within everyone, they are therefore acting for the Lord's pleasure and not for the pleasure of any ordinary human being. Those persons dealing with different demigods in the course of their Varnashram duties should similarly see the Lord as the basis of everything. They should concentrate on pleasing the Supreme Lord by all activities. This stage of life is called love of God, and it brings one to the point of actual liberation. Om jnana smarandasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshur unmidatam mena tasmai shri gurave namaham. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance unto him and to all members of Sri Parampara. So, now we see the conclusion of all of this teaching on Varna and Ashram is to come to the point of unflinching devotional service to Krishna. And that's the conclusion of everything in the Srimad Bhagavatam. As we read the Srimad Bhagavatam, sometimes, because of the way we read it, one verse a day, sometimes for months at a time, you're reading things that seem to have too much to do with Krishna. But if you go through and you read a couple of chapters or you read the conclusion, you'll see that it always comes to the point of full devotion, of unflinching devotional service to Krishna. That's the import of the second verse, Dharma Prochita Kaita Votra, that here in this Bhagavatam, all of these cheating religions, these upadharmas, these religions in the modes of nature, so to speak, are kicked out. There's no trace of that left in the Bhagavatam. And that becomes very clear when you read chapter 5, Narada's instructions to Vyasadeva on writing the Bhagavatam. The whole point is that all the other literatures that Vyasadeva had written already, including the Mahabharata, Vedas, set with their karma kanda section or instructions on various sacrifices, and even the Vedanta Sutra, none had been explicitly, clearly, solely dedicated to pure bhakti, pure devotional service. There were things mixed in because Vyasadeva was thinking, oh, people can't accept this the pure bhakti, that's really the goal. So I'll do it kind of I'll get them to, you know, read these stories in the Mahabharata, and all of a sudden they come on the Bhagavad Gita. You know, Bhagavad Gita was the essence, and that's the real purpose. Because people want to hear stories, especially in this age. We're not so qualified to sit and just meditate and listen to philosophy hour on end, which is what you do if you study Vedanta Sutra. There's no Leela there, you know. There's no description of Krishna. It's all philosophy. And even the Upanishads, you know, it's hard to just always think about that. We want to hear stories. We're attracted to adventurous stories. So he wrote this Mahabharata, and in the Mahabharata is full of all kinds of fascinating tales. And then you come across the Bhagavad Gita, which is the real essence of it. But in Bhagavatam, that's not done. There are stories, because it's a Purana, but without too much delay, you come across the bhakti part. So here we are, text 44, which if you read it through, it takes you about, you know, 5 or 6 minutes. If you just read the translation, you come upon the essence of the whole instruction. Now, what's clear, the Bhagavatam, just like the Bhagavad Gita, there's a lot of repetition, because we need repetition. We're into repetition. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Right? Because the mind is so fickle, it is so stubborn, that we need to, what did Bhaktisiddhanta say, and I forget which is which, beat it in the morning 100 times with shoes, and in the evening 100 times with a broomstick. In other words, it really needs repetition, the message gets across. So we find at the very beginning of Bhagavatam, second chapter, first canto, the essence of this understanding or teaching on Varnashram. Atak pumbir vidashreshta varnashrama vibhagashaha. Svanuschitasya dharmasa sanksidhi haritoshinam. And what Sutta Goswami is saying there, O dvijashreshta, best of the Brahmins, Sutta Goswami is speaking to all these sages assembled in Naimisharanya. And he says, all this varna, shrama, vibhagasha, the divisions according to different social classes and occupations and spiritual orders, the brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas, all of that, su anustitasya, you may do it very, very nicely. In other words, you should do your duties very nicely. But so the perfection of that will be if you satisfy Hari, satisfy Krishna. If you're doing it very nicely externally, but Krishna's not even in the picture, then it's a total failure, you see. And therefore, you find, because, you know, these books are written at kind of the juncture at Dwapara Yuga and Kali Yuga. So the whole idea of the sacrifices going on in Naimisharanya, they're concerned, they're seeing, you know, with their mystic vision, the degradation that's coming in this age. And will people really be able to follow Varnashram? Some will, maybe, and here's how you can do it if you want to do it right. But what does Narada say a few chapters later in his instruction to Vyasadeva? Chaktvasva dharmam chatadam bhajan hareya bhajanna pakpo tapate tato yadi yatrak vavabhadrama buddha mushikim kovarta apto apajatam swadharmatam. He says, if someone gives up his duties in the Varnashram, swadharma. Swadharma has to do with, you know, your psychophysical nature. Oh, okay, you're, you know, not what you're born in, although that certainly pertains. If you're the child of brilliant musicians, you're going to have the genetic makeup and you'll have the training and environment. The chances are pretty good you're going to have some music in your life. You know, you probably so the same thing is there with a Brahmin from, you know, day one. He's hearing mantras and living. So chances are you'll be a Brahmin, but it's not for sure. It still depends on your activities and your quality and your character. So this Swadharma has to do with your qualities and your character and how you're placed within Varnashram. But here he says, Chakva, give it up. Join the Hare Krishnas. You know, I may be a Brahmin, I may be a great musician, I may be whatever, you know, a champion football player or something. Babu, sweep the floor, clean the pots. Doesn't matter who you are, you know. This is not according to, you know, psychophysical nature. I mean, that comes later. You may be engaged in that way. But the point is, kirtan. There's no hint of Varnashram Dharma in it. You know, the only thing that we do, you know, is separate the men and women a little bit. That's the you know, that's what the concession to the externals. But young and old, you know, Brahman and Shudra, Chandala and Paramahansa, everybody's meant to chant and dance. It's to completely beyond. And that's the essence of the Yuga Dharma. So here, what Narada is saying, you may give it up and join the Hare Krishnas, but due to some reason or other, you don't complete the course and you fall away. It happens all the time, right? Even we've seen in our short history right here in this temple in the last year. So, tukvasvadharmam chadanam bhajan hare bhajan. And you worship bhajan, that word is in this verse, the lotus feet of Hari. In other words, that's pure bhakti. But, apakvo, I like this word apakvo. You know the word shvapacha? Shvapacha means the dog cookers, the dog eaters. You know, you figure if you cook them, you're going to eat them, right? So they're dog eaters. So paka, apakvo means uncooked. Your bhakti is not cooked yet. It's not fully done, you know, and you leave. So it means immature, and you fall away. He says, what's there any loss? Where abhadram, where is there anything inauspicious? Because we know right from Bhagavad Gita that any advancement on this path cannot be diminished. Right? There is no loss or diminution. Notice the pronunciation. Diminution, not diminution. And so there's no loss. In other words, whatever status or whatever assets you accumulate in this life, you may stay in the ashram for one day. You may just chant a couple of mantras of Hare Krishna. Next birth, you'll chant a few more, you know, if that's all you do this life. You see what I'm saying? So, and then on the other side, he says, So suppose one very nicely follows his swadharma, but there's no bhajan. In other words, Krishna is not in the picture. Where is there anything auspicious in that? You may worship the gods, you may chant all the mantras, you may go to the holy places, you may perform sacrifices and perform all kinds of austerities, but if it's not for the purpose of advancing in Krishna consciousness, it's shrama eva hi kevalam. Completely useless. All you get out of it is the hard labor that you put into it. This phrase comes up again and again. You know, if whatever you're doing, now, you know, what is real dharma? So this is part of this whole series of verses. Very important section. If you're going to study Bhagavatam is very vast. Sometimes it's very imposing. And you say, where am I going to start? How can I, you know, I can only read 1 hour a day. It'll take me 10 years to focus. Just if you have on this section, that's starting in the second chapter, sixth verse, and going to about verse 20, 21, like that. There's a full, complete lesson in bhakti right there. Prabhupada spoke so much on these verses, we made a book out of it, taking the essence of these lectures. It was called Dharma, The Way of Transcendence. Nice book. So the question was, what is the real dharma? By which the soul can be completely satisfied. In all these cheating religions, the soul is never satisfied. So there's always, you're always praying to God to give you something. That means you're not satisfied by the dharma itself, right? People don't just go to church to go to church. They're going to church to pray, save me from this, give me this, I'm sick, this and that, whatever. They want something. But real dharma means that by the dharma itself, you become satisfied. You don't want anything from Krishna except service, except love. That's the prayer. So within the course of these verses, it says dharmas svanachitak pungsam, the same thing. Dharma svanachitak pungsam vishvakshena katasayak na utpadaye jariratim shrama eva hi kevalam. That's where that phrase comes from. Shrama eva hi kevalam means the shrama is all you get. That's the hard labor. So what does this verse say? It says, dharma svanachitak pungsam, that person who nicely follows his dharma, whether it's varnashram dharma or some other dharma, the measure of success is that you become more and more attracted to hear about Krishna. Vishvakshena katasu yak na utpadiye jadiratim. If there's no rati, attraction, for the kata, for genuine glorification of Hari, then it's completely useless. So let's see. Go to any other religion, established or unestablished, and see, are people becoming more and more attracted here about Krishna? Probably not. As soon as the service is over, they're all gabbing about something that has nothing to do with God. And when they go home, they wait until the next Sunday. There's all kinds of things that the mind is attracted to because it's not genuine dharma. Genuine dharma is meant to connect us to Krishna Krishna specifically, who is all attractive and who draws your mind so much that eventually you're not interested in anything else. In other words, it's meant to purify the soul of all of the contamination of this material life. So that's what Krishna is saying here. You may practice your prescribed duty, and if you have no other worship object of worship but me as you prescribe that duty, and you remain conscious of me as present in all living entities, then you will achieve unflinching devotional service to me. So that's quite a trick. It's not easy to do that. It requires training. It requires real training. And in this age, it's very hard to do that within Varnashram. Prabhupada wanted it, but whenever he talked about Varnashram, he's always talking about some community out in the country where you can have all the Varnas nicely represented, including Vaishyas, you know, cow protection. And there's a controlled environment where, you don't have all of this impinging stuff coming in like when you're in the city. In the city, environment like this, I am at a loss to see how you can truly practice Varnashram Dharma. Now, it's not that some of us will not take up a brahminical role and others may go toward a different kind of role. But basically, the city temples are mostly, you know, just for transcendental hearing and chanting, book distribution, preaching, and trying to train people up in the highest level of devotional service. So Varnashram is really meant for when you can have all of these Varnas and ashrams represented. Now, it's true that we have Brahmacharya Ashram and Grihastha Ashram in the city, but most of what we're trying to do is pure bhakti. When you have this morning program, there's nothing Varnashram-ish about it, sitting there and chanting japa. You know, that's not Varnashram. I mean, that's a duty of a brahmachari and everyone in the Hare Krishna movement. But it's not a brahmachari thing. Everyone's supposed to do it. And this is something that I want to emphasize, because I know from, you know, being in this movement for a long time, when Prabhupada talked about Varnashram, he talked about it as something that's a structure in which you can organize a society, even our little society. But the basic principles that he taught of becoming strong in Krishna consciousness were not meant to be compromised. In other words, the morning program was meant to go on, and then the rest of the day you can do your varna and you can do your occupational duty. But generally, I've seen what happens because of the exigencies of trying to make Varnashram work, that it's very difficult to do that, you know. There's so many things to be done in the morning, there's so much work to be done, late at night, or you're exhausted, or this or that. It impinges generally. You have to be careful, but it can impinge on the regular sadhana bhakti. Because very quickly, you can feel, what am I doing just, plowing this field behind a cow, you know. If you're not fully, chanting verses in Hare Krishna while you're doing that, you'll be in Maya, you know. And in America, we've had many efforts in trying to actually set up foreign communities. And as far as I can see, there's no real success that's happened over long term. So anyway, the whole idea of this, everything that Krishna is talking about is that we're meant to come to the unflinching devotional service, and to see him present in every living entity. This is spoken also by Pallad, which I think the verse may have left me at this point, but it's one of these Eta Avana Viloka Ismin Punsang Dharma Paraksmita. What is it? Unflinching devotional service to Govinda, by which you see Krishna in everything. This is the real dharma for everybody in this world, is to practice bhakti yoga so you can see God in everything. And what does that mean? How do we practically come to that point? It means that by strict following of the sadhana and the act of trying to spread Krishna consciousness, what are we trying to do? If you speak to someone about Krishna, if you distribute a book, if you go on Harinam, you're trying to awaken that soul, right? Or whatever soul is receptive to the reality. You're seeing that Krishna is there. Excuse me, we're not allowed to point the feet at Prabhupada. Yeah, that's right. The soul is there in the heart, so is the super soul. Krishna's there, but people are looking out. They're not perceiving that, right? We're not perceiving it either, but at least we're trying to. And we know it's the truth. So by the act of trying to awaken Krishna, people to Krishna who's there in their hearts, you're seeing that. You're understanding that God is there in the heart. And Krishna gives you that vision. He starts to reveal to you that yes, he's there in everything, in everyone. So by the principle of service, especially hearing and chanting and keeping the mind focused on Krishna, you begin to see that he's truly there in everything animate and inanimate. I'd like to point out how this is a 180 degree different vision than what you find propagated by modern science. Modern science tries to depersonalize everything, even to the point where personality and consciousness can be duplicated by computers. This artificial intelligence thing. Now they're saying yes, we almost have it. You know, just a few more months or years, and we'll produce a computer and a robot that can do everything you can do, and then it's off to the races, and they'll be even doing more than you can do. Everything. It'll love, it'll cry, and do all this stuff. It's completely bogus. But this is the myth. And in the course of doing that, they depersonalize even the human being. You know, you go to a psychiatrist now. So many people are mentally upset, disturbed, and depressed, can't sleep, whatever. And what'll happen? You know, they'll give you some drug. 99% of the time, they give something to calm you down, fire you up, whatever they do. So what does that mean? It means that everything is now, your consciousness is just a result of brain chemistry, right? Now they've got it figured out. That means that life comes from matter. That means that consciousness comes from matter, you see? They're trying to reduce consciousness, which is really what personality is all about, to exactly what it says in the 16th chapter. It's just a bunch of atoms and molecules reacting to each other, you see? So where is Krishna in all this, the Supreme Consciousness? We learn that consciousness, personality, the Supreme Personality, is all-pervading. There's not an atom that moves that doesn't have someone moving it, you know? Everything, what do we learn? We read the Bhagavad Gita in the 13th chapter. Everything in this world is but a combination of the higher energy, the conscious energy called the soul or spirit or atma, and the lower energy, this material. So where is there, just like our bodies, a combination, right? These hands are moving and all of this, just earth, water, fire, and air, and ether, right? And the subtle elements. And we're in there. So we're a combination. We're trying to get rid of this combination and get free of this. But now we're a combination. But how does that work for this floor? How does that work for the air? Well, there's a god of the air, there's a god of the earth, goddess of the earth. Every element has its own person behind it, right? And just like, I like to point out, you know, just visualize a thought experiment for a moment. Suppose a little ant, you know, is crawling on my body. I don't even know it, right? Now, suppose that ant, you know, had more than antish consciousness, and he was thinking, where am I now, you know? Wow, this is quite a little mountain here, and there's these trees, my little hairs on my leg or something, you know. That's what he's thinking. He doesn't think that there's a person there. You see what I'm saying? He doesn't see me. He just sees my toenail, you know, and that's his consciousness. So we're sitting on the universal form of Krishna, the external body of God. It's spoken of like that in Bhagavatam, yes. But we're not seeing that there's a person there, that everything is personal. I'm moving my hand, well, that's a personal act. I have a desire, it's going like this. So similarly, this whole world is moving because of Krishna and because of the demigods and everything. And we know every atom contains a super soul. That's personal, that's consciousness. There's nowhere where there isn't consciousness. Just the opposite of the demonic scientists. They're ultimately saying, there's nowhere where there's consciousness. It's all just random acts of the, you know, you see. So our job, you know, personally also is so that we don't depersonalize. Because as soon as we try to use something for our own sense gratification, we have to forget that it belongs to Krishna. That this thing is part of the you know, energy of Krishna, and the way that demigod who controls that will be happy is if you use it in Krishna's service. That's in Kapila Dev. You read Kapila Dev's teaching. Is that the demigods are in charge of your senses. You know, we know that, right? Every sense has its own god. There's many prominent ones and also not so prominent ones. There's thousands, even millions of them. And the natural function of the mind is to think of Krishna and serve Krishna. But now it's not. We have to fight to bring the mind back under the control of the holy name by chanting our japa. You know? So, but the natural function is to always think of them and have the senses serve the master of the senses, Rishikesh. You see? And then the demigods become happy with us. They, oh, now you're using this part of my energy in Krishna's service, you see? That paraphernalia. They're much more happy than if you use it to serve them. At least that's something. You recognize the, you know, the gods in the third chapter, you know. But more, they're even happier when you used to serve Krishna. You don't have to worry about anything else. Otherwise, we have so many debts. I was just listening to Prabhupada. You know, we come into this world, we're full of debts. Devashi bhutat nam patrinam. Nakin karonayam rini charai. Rini means a debtor, right? So we owe the devas. The very breath that we breathe, the water that we drink, the sunlight. There's a god behind that. And if we don't recognize that and make offerings, we're thieves. Third chapter, Bhagavad Gita. If you don't offer it back to the gods, you're thieves. So can a thief ever be happy? No. Deep down inside, you'll never be happy this way. So this verse by Narada Muni, he's saying, if you surrender unto Mukunda, the one who's worthy of taking it, gato mukundam sharanam sharanyam, you see, and then your obligations are finished. Because it's just like you consolidate your debts, you know, when you have all these credit cards, consolidate your debts. You just pay once a month, you know, to one entity, one bank or something, and then it's gradually is taken care of. So we can consolidate all our debts. Now, who do we have debts to? The devas. The bhutas means other creatures, human beings. What about our parents? You know, nowadays, people are so selfish, they're so besotted with all of this, you know, media, whatever it is, that they don't even think they have an obligation to take care of their parents. Some people now, you know. They just put them off in the nursing home and forget about them. Call them once a week or something, you know. The horror show in those nursing homes. Do you imagine what it's like? You know? So, the bhutas, we have the pitris, forefathers, parents. Devashi bhuta apta, relatives, pitrinam, and people in general. We all have obligations. You're born with it. And but if you surrender unto Krishna, then all of those obligations are forgotten. You're free. That's one of the reasons why it's so, you know, if you really get into Krishna consciousness, even a little bit, you feel lighter, you feel freer, you know. Because deep down inside, you know, is that you've gotten rid of so much karma, so many debts, all these things. We don't realize it. Just like, you know, you take some health food or something. You don't know what's going on, but after a while you feel better. You know, it's natural. So the point is that we're meant to cultivate this vision, as mentioned in this verse, to see Krishna everywhere, to see everything in relation to Krishna. And it can only take place when we get out of the sense gratificatory mood. That's where the infection is. And that sense is the false ego. You know, so it's a battle. It's a battle between the real ego and the false ego. The real ego means we're fired up to do service, we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're doing our duty. Great. We feel enlivened, chanting and dancing. We're connected to Krishna. He likes it. You're doing what you're supposed to do. But then the first thing when you're slackening off your duty is to forget Krishna. The mind is wandering, you know, it's rebelling against this idea of surrender. It's the mind is you know, meant to further the false ego. I remember Burijan Prabhu talking about that, how this conditioned mind is meant to feed the false ego and protect it against having to come to the point of real ego. So it has to be trained. It's like a wild horse. What's that verse? Bhavodbhava klesha kashasa tahata paribraman indriya kapatantare niyamyatam madhava me manohayas tarangri shanko dhidabhakta bandane. Beautiful verse from Pajavali. It says, arising out of life in the material world, bhava udbhava, klesha, so many miseries. Do I have to enumerate them? Just think of the tidal wave. You know, we've all conscious of that. Where did that come from? You know, hundreds of thousands of millions of people going about their days, you know, doing the thing there in Japan, highly industrialized country, you know, all of it. Boom. Next minute, it's being all washed away. People you love have disappeared, you know, the horror show. That's the material world. So he says, klesha kasha, my mind is being beaten by hundreds and hundreds of these kleshas, these whips. The horse of my mind is being beaten by these whips that just arise out of life in the material world. Bhavo bhava, klesha kasha chatahala, and paribrahmam. The mind is wandering on the dangerous path of the senses, for sense gratification. Indriya kapatantare. Kapata means dangerous path. Pata, same word in Sanskrit and English. So what's the solution? Niyamitam madhava. O madhava, you please control my mind. Bring it on. Niyamitam madhava me manohayas. Mano means the horse of my mind. Wild stallion. Manohayas. Twadangli sanko dudabhakta bandhane. And with the strong reins of devotional service to you, tie it. Tie his mind to the hitching post of your lotus feet. That's what it is, the prayer. So that's what we can pray like that. You know, oh Madhava, you please help me to become strong in devotional service. That's the kind of prayer that we should do. You have to pray. We should chant Hare Krishna prayerfully. You know, it's simultaneously a glorification, a prayer, and a meditation. So all three of those come into play, you know. The Harinam Sankirtan, right? What is it? Is it yoga? Is it religion? You know, it's simultaneously glorification and prayer and meditation. The mind is also meant to be on. You know, even in Harinam Sankirtan, your mind can go off everywhere. You know, but pray, you know, chanting prayerfully. What are we praying for? Prabhupada said, "O Krishna, O Radharani, please engage me in your service. You know, lift me up like a child, a helpless child lost on the beach. Mommy, you know, Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna, Krishna." This is our actual position. We're in this well that we dug ourselves. It's our fault. And we can't get out on our own. We need help. So a little, you know, how does Krishna save us? He sends the guru. He sends the realized soul to teach us, to give us all this facility. He gives us association. He gives us prasadam. He gives us the holy name. All of these are gifts from Krishna. And and inside the gift is the interest in it, the faith, the preliminary faith. That's you know, especially the gift of the acharya. Instills the faith. Brahmanda brahmatiko bhagyavan jeev kuru krishna basare pe bhakti lata beach. This is Lord Chaitanya's beginning of his teachings to Rupa Goswami. We're wandering for millions of births, up and down the universe, so many species, helpless, hopeless. Brahmandi Brahmana Kon Bhagavan, the fortunate jiva, the fortunate soul, by the mercy of both Krishna and Guru, gets the seed of the creeper of devotion. What is that seed? What form does it take? It takes the form of the words, the instructions, and given in a way, you know, with the unique power of the real acharya, that it enters the heart. In other words, it instills faith in the words. The words come with the installation of faith in the words. And so by that faith, if we allow it to enter the heart and it gets planted, and we water it nicely by hearing and chanting, and we avoid the offenses, you know, that's sadhana, then the creeper grows and grows. And as it grows, we start to feel the benefit. You know, the cloud lifts, you know, over our consciousness. We're happy, peaceful. We're getting more, you know. It's not, you know, sometimes down. It's a sadhana practice. But that's how to do it. You know, it's nicely described. I highly recommend Mighty Leela Chapter 19. And TLC, which is coming out soon, also nicely summarizes Rupa Goswami's, the teachings of Rupa Goswami. So we've come to that point. And you'll see the rest of this chapter is talking about bhakti, the last few verses. And, you know, those who are in Varnashram, this is the success, to come to the point described in this verse, which I'll read one more time. One who worships me by his prescribed duty, having no other object of worship, and who remains conscious of me as present in all living entities, achieves unflinching devotional service unto me.
I heard a few devotees, I heard Mahatma Tathapuru and a few other devotees, they were saying that It's people that come to devotional life and, you know, they like it and they start practicing it and this and that. And then at one point they kind of get to a point where they realize kind of where they are. Like, oh my God, I'm a lot contaminated than I think. And then they just give up. They don't have, like, the courage or the guts to kind of, like, you know, plow through those, you know, those problems. And then I heard other devotees, you know, say that people don't get past the anartha nirvritti stage, the stage of getting all that contamination out. So how to reach that, I mean, how to get past that stage of like, okay, this is where I'm at, and now I have to face all these anarthas internally, and how to, like, you know,
yes,
successfully plow through those without...
All right, so the question is, because sometimes people come to Krishna consciousness, but after some time it becomes clear just how difficult it is to become purified. You're confronted...
How fallen they are.
Yeah, we become confronted with so many deep-seated unwanted things called anarthas that we didn't even know were there. So after an initial burst of enthusiasm... you can see that it's a very difficult process and people lose enthusiasm or determination. Well, first of all, I want to emphasize that we have to help each other, you know, that that's what the whole idea of the ashram is, of coming together and helping each other, you know, to overcome these things, these difficulties. You know, if we're living together but we're not helping each other, then we're not really taking advantage of what it means to live in an ashram. The adoption of the regulations is so important. You know, I once heard, this is in a class, I forget who was giving the class, but it's true, that anything that you do on a regular basis, you become habituated to, and it's no longer something that you're like trying to achieve. I like to use the example of playing a musical instrument because I, as I pointed out, I learned three times how to play different musical instruments. So it's just like that. You know, you're trying to play. I played the clarinet, I played the flute, you know, and there's so many, there's hurdles to overcome. You know, you can't do this arpeggio, you can't, you know, your fingers are just not working, you can't coordinate the tom, whatever it is, and wind instruments. And, but there's a certain method for it. In other words, if you hold it the right way, you know, and if you're using the right breath and so forth, then it becomes, you have a better chance of breaking through that barrier and coming to the point where it's spontaneous and automatic, because that's what we're trying to get to. So the program that's been set up, you know, and it's nice to know that it was an organic process. Prabhupada didn't, you know, when he first started, you read the history, what is 26 Second Avenue? There's no Mangala Arti, there's no deities, there's nothing, you know. There was just Prabhupada and the holy name and him speaking in those three books, the first canto, which was a lot, but it wasn't like what we have today. And gradually it evolved, you know, Prabhupada instituted what we have today, and which consists of, you know, Mangala Arti, you know, with all of its prayers. Once again, I'll encourage you all, please learn the meaning of every word in these prayers. There's a finite number of things, you know, the Tulsi prayer, the Nishinga prayer, even the Prema Dwani. Everything that we chant, if you understand it, it'll deepen your experience tenfold or hundredfold. That's where the nectar is in understanding exactly what's going on at every moment of this service, you know. And we can deal with that some other time with more time. Yeah, a little more time. So, if we, you know, the Mangala Arti, the Prema Dwani prayers, the Nrisimha prayers, the Tulsi prayers, the offering the obeisance to the devotees, the 10 offenses, and of course the japa, and the Guru Puja, and the class. This is the morning program. It's about 4.5 hours long. Now, if one can follow that, even if his mind is going off, he has so many doubts, that will provide a structure that eventually the mind will become used to that and you'll get more and more out of it. That Maya works by making you unregulated, you know, by making you unregulated. Oh, you eat too much, then you have to sleep too much, you can't concentrate, you know, you get sick. That's a real big, you know, weapon of Maya. Suddenly you're unregulated and the mind goes wild, you know. And so becoming regulated in eating and sleeping and waking and all of these things is a first prerequisite for getting to that platform of steadiness where you have hope and confidence that, yes, I'm on the path and I'm making progress. Now, you know, the idea of faith, and then we'll end here because we are going over time. What does faith mean? You have faith in Krishna. You have faith in the process. You have faith in the guru. But if you start to become discouraged and say, oh, I can't do this, I'm too impure, I can't, you know, that means you don't really have faith in Krishna. Cannot Krishna, if he's all-powerful, empower anyone, any living entity? We have so many examples in the Shastra, you know. Hanuman, you know, they're just monkeys. You know, Magari the hunter, you know, he was like worse than anyone you probably meet on the street, half-killing animals, you know, and all that stuff. And there's all kinds of so-called disqualified people. Lord Chaitanya was taking, you know, people from the lowest social strata, impure, Jagai Madai. So, who are we, you know? You know, yes, we're Kali Yugites, but if Krishna is truly all-powerful, then he can even empower us. But we have to pray hard enough. The mind is very tricky. It's using an excuse that you're unqualified to leave the association of devotees. You see what I'm saying? Or the excuse is, no, I haven't experienced enough sense gratification. I'm not pessimistic about it enough. Let me go out there, get it, you know, really blow it away, and then I'll really believe, you know, yeah, it's true, and then I'll come back. But the problem is that just engaging in sense gratification covers your knowledge. We forget that we can forget. We forget how forgetful, you know, we are at this moment. And we're thinking that our present state of mind, we have it all together where we can use our reason. You can't. If you allow the senses to run riot, then the mind is going riot and becoming covered, and your interest in Krishna consciousness can be lost. For like 30 years, I've seen it. Till finally, you know, you have a disease that is going to kill you, then come back. You know, we don't want that. You know, I've seen that among my God brothers and God sisters. Where were they for the last 20 years? Oh, they got entangled, forgot. But then they remembered, yeah, the only time I was really happy, the only thing of value was when I was with the devotees. And they come in the association of devotees. That's all to the good, but that's not what we want to do. Anyway, there's much to be said on this topic. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.